Well, welcome everyone. I appreciate you inviting me in here to talk about a subject that I rather enjoy, that's actually keeping money out of the insurance company's pockets. So with that, we have a three-hour excursion here on risk management, just getting condensed down to 45 minutes, about how you could actually help drive down your insurance rates by making yourself more attractive. Does that sound like a good subject? So what we're going to go over today is an understanding of how underwriters determine your premium, what actually impacts their decisions, hopefully a better way for you to understand how you can market your insurance more effectively to get better results, like we talked about getting your premiums down, and also a couple other items that will be able to help you along the way. So, when I was first asked to speak here, I reached out to quite a number of the members here in the organization. And if you like this presentation, you could thank them. If you don't, you can blame me. But they gave me a little bit of insight as to some of the challenges and issues that you're all facing so that I can make certain that I try to address them as we go through these. I also spoke to a number of underwriters, loss control professionals from insurance companies to really get their side of the equation, so ultimately, we can help you achieve results. So these were the issues that they brought up. Obviously, the cost of insurance. But the number one and number two, which I thought was interesting, was whether it dealt with getting the timber or finding and hiring and retaining employees. A lot of the issues we just talked about a moment ago with the millennials. Now, what's really interesting is your insurance costs and dealing with your employees go hand in hand. There's a lot of similarities and synergies that go around these that will actually help you address your insurance costs. When I spoke to your colleagues, these were some of the questions or comments that they made with regard to their property insurance. Maybe you share some of their frustrations. They had quite a number of colorful expressions that they chose when they spoke about workers' compensation and potentially employee taking advantage of them. But lastly, they did talk in quite length about their frustrations dealing with the insurance industry at all, overall. As you can see from the points up there, a lot of it has to do with them maybe not understanding how insurance system works, maybe not having an agent that really understands what they do. But ultimately, you know, it's not clear to them as to what they can do to address their concerns, which is obviously the increasing insurance costs. So what's been going on? Well, as we all know, over the last couple of years, there's been a shrinkage of the number of companies that are writing, particularly property insurance, in your industry. With Pennsylvania and Indiana Lumbermen's merging, you have Lumbermen's Underwriting Alliance that went belly up trying to insure a PEO. So there, when you have few players, yes, the law of supply and demand does take over and premiums will increase. However, as premiums increased over the last 2 years or so, other players are coming in. I'll call them a dabbler because I don't know exactly how long they're going to be in the market. I've already seen one come in and go out. So we have to see, is there going to be a new steady player in this industry or not? But some of them would come in, only want to deal with sprinkler systems, only want to deal as a part of a layer or a quota share where they're taking a portion of the risk. And some aren't even licensed to do business in your state. They're surplus lines, which basically means if you have a problem and you have to deal with it, you cannot go to your insurance department to back you. You have to deal with them yourself. So, but the industry trends from claims in the past do seem to be appearing to get better. A lot of companies recognizing when the fires were occurring and their premiums were going up were taking steps to make themselves more attractive to get their rates down. So what do you do? Like we talked about, when your rates are going up, obviously make yourself more attractive to the insurance industry. When you have fewer players, you have to make yourself more attractive. Case in point, you could have an underwriter that says, I'm going to pass on quoting your business. Then you could have an underwriter that says, okay, Bob, I think I'll quote your business to you know what, I really like this account, I want to write this piece of business. Where do you want to be in that spectrum? And that has to do with how attractive you are, which basically trying to make yourself more attractive is what we call risk profile improvement, making yourself more attractive over time, because you don't want to do it all at once. Now, what you have to understand is your premium is based on an underwriter's perception of risk, what they view your risk to be, good or bad, but it's their perception. It might not be actual reality. So you have to overcome what is their perception and create a better perception. It does start with the insurance agent. How well does your insurance agent convey you to the underwriter to even get them interested in going to the next step, which is actually bringing in a loss control person that will come in, be the eyes and ears of the underwriter, and do a write-up and go back to the underwriter and say, here is what we saw. Why is this so important? Well, years ago, I went through underwriting school. I actually have a degree in risk management insurance from Penn State. And one summer, I spent an entire summer learning about underwriting and actually underwrote accounts. The one thing I learned was an underwriter does not get in trouble for not writing an account. They only get in trouble when they write the wrong one. So if they have a big claim, they have bad losses, somebody up top is going to say, why did you write this and why did you price it this way? So they need the ammunition, the documentation from that agent and from that loss control to say, this is why you're a better risk. And we'll go into what they're looking at. Now, what's also interesting is my underwriter once told me, he says, David, there are no bad risks, just the wrong premium. You can write anything if you write premium. Whether or not somebody wants to pay that, that's another story. So, understanding how to make yourself more attractive is basically digging into risk management. Understanding what are the issues that you're facing, what are the impacts and implications on your company, and then prioritizing them and figuring out how do we address them and improve them. Then we go in and actually implement that. This is also a step where you would also do risk transfer or buy insurance, implement your programs. And lastly, you're going to review everything, make some adjustments, and then start the process all over. Now, this is where I will say that the insurance procurement or purchase marketing is broken when you go out to market your insurance. Why I say that is that typically, the process is focused on the quote. This is where the agent comes in, which is step four, the placement of insurance. Insurance agents are going to come in, they're asked for your loss runs, ask for your declaration pages, maybe take a tour, but they're trying to complete an application just to give the basics to the underwriter that they need. They're focusing on, they're trying to figure out what coverages you might be missing so that they could try to upsell you additional coverages to show their value. Well, if they don't understand your business and understand the risks and can convey the quality of company you are, anything that you purchase in that light is going to be at a higher premium. So I contend that you should change how you buy your insurance. Thinking of it this way, would you buy a house by asking in three real estate agents, saying, I want a four-bedroom house, two-and-a-half bath, two-car garage on 2 acres or more? And then the real estate agents show up, each with a listing, and you look at the listings, and you buy the house. Bob's shaking his head, no. But that's how you buy insurance, isn't it? Do you buy a car by looking at a newspaper and saying, hey, it's a pretty good price, I'll go buy the car? No, you take a test drive. I contend you should take the prospective agent for a test drive. Invite them in, see how well they analyze risks. Can they dig in and understand your company? Because a lot of agents will come and say, oh, we got loss control. We got safety. We'll do risk management. And they tell you what they're going to do, but they don't show you what they're capable of doing. Have them come in, understand your company, and come back and say specifically what they're going to do for you. Not, oh, well, we got some trainings we'll do for you. No, what are they doing? What are they addressing? And how are they going to address it? And why are they addressing it? A lot of them have the how, but they understand, or they have the what, but they don't understand how or why something needs to be done. So take the time, and most businesses I found that have successfully implemented and reduced their costs over time have first decided who they're going to deal with from that procurement of insurance standpoint, and then let them go onto the marketplace and create that feeding frenzy for their insurance because they understand their business, convey a better picture to an underwriter. Hopefully that makes sense. So the one thing I also want to make sure you understand is that you don't have to bite it all off at once. Take steps, one step at a time, to improve your risk profile so that you end up with what we call the insurance negotiation advantage at the end of your policy. So each year you can go back and say to an insurance company, this is why today we're a better risk than last year, why we're a better risk than 2 years ago. They're still going to be looking at loss runs, the data, so you have to have a story to show why you're better than what the data is. So, do you do business the same way you did 20, 30 years ago? Of course not. You probably don't even do business the same way you did 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But when I talk to business owners, a lot of them still think that insurance is doing things the same way, and they most certainly are buying insurance the same way. But I will tell you, the insurance industry has dramatically changed how they do business. When I went through underwriting, everything that we looked at was either provided to us by an agent or was sitting in a manual. Today, that is dramatically different. They are looking, come on, everything up here. It's a lot of information they're analyzing. They're building a profile of what you are. For example, if you have, let's say, 40 employees, and on your loss runs, they see that you're averaging 4 or 5 injuries a year, they're going to say, man, you have a frequency problem. You may have only paid $1,000 in claims over the year, and you're paying $40,000 or $50,000 in premium, so they're making money on you, but they're going to say, you're having 10% of your workforce hurt every year. You're due for a big one. I'm going to price you higher than somebody that has one claim that might be $5,000, because that's how you're going to score when they put the information into the computer system. They're going to look at not only do we have aging infrastructure on roads and streets, but we're seeing aging infrastructure in water supply systems. There's municipalities that are being downgraded in terms of because their systems may be leaking, not being able to deliver pressure. I was working with a company in eastern Pennsylvania that recently had their premium increased because the municipality got downgraded. The insurance company sent out and paid the fire company to hook up to the hydrant and pressure test and see how long the flow was, and they determined that there was improper water supply to help fight the fire. Very simple. Now we got a water retention pond on property with a dry hydrant that the fire company could hook up to help fight that fire, and the rates went back down. So you have to look at all the variables that they're plugging into this, and it is quite extensive. They're able to do this because, face it, computers, storage is cheap. You can buy, I bought a thumb drive that has 64 gigabyte. I think it's about $20 on it. Data processing speed is high, but colleges like my alma mater, Penn State, are cranking out actuaries, 75 to 100 a year, and all they do is slice and dice data. It's much like any of you seen the movie with that dashing, debonair, great actor of Jonah Hill and that Brad Pitt guy. Well, scouts used to go out and say, hey, that guy, he's got a really smooth swing. You know, he can throw, he could run, he makes headsy plays. It's all, that gut feeling, the experience of the scout. Jonah sat back, slice and dice, and says, what's your on-base percentage? What's your strikeout rates? What's your fielding errors? All that kind of stuff. What's your salary? In the Oakland A's, year after year, we're making the playoffs with some of the lowest payroll out in baseball. They built a better mousetrap. That's what insurance companies are trying to do, build a better mousetrap. Why? Because they want to drive more profits for their shareholders. They want to identify what risks they should be writing and what ones they shouldn't be. The ones that they write, yes, they will get more aggressive on. Those that they don't want to write, they're going to go up in price. It's all data, not just your insurance company. It's the reinsurers. It's everybody down the line. But it's just a model. The underwriter has to score you to go in. but they're also looking at the internet. Stuff is readily available on your company. They could look at an aerial photo of your facility and see how close your facilities are, measure the distances, see how much material you store in your yard, how you store it, without even coming out to see you. They could go on and look online at OSHA and see how many violations you've had. And if you're not managing your employees to the point where you're having OSHA violations, what are you doing from a quality control standpoint goes through the underwriter's mind. So, stepping back and looking at property. The first thing that everybody's experienced, you've heard insurance companies say, well, we can no longer insure you because you have too much in values. It's called maximum probable loss. They look at a company and say, based on the total values for, let's say, a fire, building, contents, business income, code issues, we can't absorb more than this amount of loss. Now, a couple of your colleagues said, well, wait a minute, somebody down the street is still insured with them. They had more values than I did. Well, they also look at how far apart the buildings are spread. So it was like, for example, when I was talking to everybody was complaining about the premium going up, but Northern Hardwoods, John Cantola, basically said theirs really didn't change much. Well, they have their warehouse, they have their kiln, they have the sawmill over here with distances about 75 feet apart, their metal buildings, and there's nothing stored in between. So each one of those buildings is being viewed as a separate fire. So they're not aggregating them all together. If he would have had material stored up in between them, then an underwriter is more likely to aggregate that and say, we're going to charge you a higher rate because we're exposed to more of a loss. So you have to look at how you store things as well. Because ultimately, their reinsurers or insurance companies are going to say, we can or can't do this based on the values. And that's why you're seeing layering or quota sharing where multiple companies are coming in and underwriting one policy. Because none of them want to take the whole loss. Because insurance companies don't even want to take the whole loss. They buy reinsurance. So when you talk to underwriters, these are the issues that they're looking at. Now, what's really interesting is if you just shift a little bit and you ask the general liability, your auto, your workers' comp underwriters, there's only two things added. How you manage claims and injuries, and how you deal with your fleet safety. Everything else is identical to what they ask on the property. When I was talking to your colleagues, a lot of them seemed a little surprised at that, but in reality, it's how the underwriters all look at a business. And it all starts with the very first thing that every one of them looks at is the quality of ownership and management. Are they engaged? If they're going, let's put it this way. I cannot tell you how many times I've been asked to come in and help a company that's been having claims that says, we got safety manuals, we do this training, we do that training. The training's mostly focused at OSHA, but they have all these things. But when you go into the shop, you can see nothing's really being enforced, nothing's in practice. They're talking the talk, but not walking the walk. So insurance companies are looking at that, and they're going to score you based on how well they see you do everything else we're going to be talking about. So when you have a program, the best thing to do is have somebody responsible for monitoring, measuring, and checking, checklists of your program. But ultimately, you need to, as management and owners, go in and check and inspect what you expect even from your managers. Case in point, now this isn't related to a sawmill. We deal with a large chain of automobile dealerships. We had made them more attractive, reduced their losses, and basically cut their premium by a couple $100,000 over a period of 3 years, but we continued to have a problem with one location. We had an employee amputate a foot, or part of a foot, dropping a rotor on it, despite they're supposed to have hard-toe shoes, and we continue to have things like rust in the eye. So we did our review, myself, my safety person, went out and met with the owner, and we're at that facility, and I finally said, let's just go out and see in the shop and see what's going on. Guys were wearing tennis shoes, guys were not wearing their goggles. Owner starts yelling at everybody. Their policy was to send them home, go get your boots and come back, dock them, send them, dock them, pay. But I looked at him and I said, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, this has been going on all day. Why hasn't they gone and put their stuff on? Owner goes, walks over to the service manager and says, why aren't these guys doing what they're supposed to do? Service manager says, I yell at them, I scream at them, they still don't do it. Well, aren't they supposed to go home? Well, if I send them home, we wouldn't be getting work done. I got to get the cars out. Wrong answer. The next person who went home was the service manager for a week unpaid. Interestingly enough, when you hear about repercussions of a decision, that was a positive repercussion throughout the whole organization. Every other manager snapped to attention, and employees heard that ownership suspended management for not doing what they're supposed to do. Employees started doing it. We haven't had an incident since of somebody not doing what they're supposed to do at that location. So inspect what you expect. If you ever get a chance, read the book Power of Habit. When Paul O'Neill was going to become the CEO of Alcoa, the industry thought that he was going to expand. He was going to acquire to increase shareholder value. He says, no, safety is going to be our number one priority. Well, what about this? What about that? Safety is going to be our number one priority. And they were already better than industry average. What he showed was that the most productive way of doing something is the safest way. So by focusing on that, he improved not only productivity, improved communication lines, improved morale around the workplaces. It's a pretty interesting read if you get a chance. Okay, hiring. We just spoke, and you hit the nail on the head about going after them at trade schools, and actually we're seeing, and you should go after them in 8th and 9th grade. But it has to do with attracting in because it's how they are brought up. There are some culture issues surrounding millennials I'll get to in a second, but hiring is a key thing. Underwriters want to know how you are hiring. How are you screening? How are you training your employees? Because that affects quality control. That affects how they work. Do they do shortcuts that are causing them to have fires? So they are very vested. Now, interestingly, everybody that I talked to, except for one, was screaming about their work comp premium, too. Mark Williams, Jerry Williams, was the only one that wasn't screaming. He said years ago he hired a company that came in with safety professionals, and they basically became their on-staff but not on-payroll safety company. In a couple times a month, did safety trainings, ran safety committee, overhauled his processes, and was there to be engaged and actually implement for him. They overhauled his hiring processes, put a new handbook in place, and the one thing he said that I should convey to you is he did two other things. He did drug testing, and he also did physicals before hiring. That prevented somebody that had a pre-existing injury from becoming an employee and getting hurt. Number two, he figures the talent pool is shallow. Why start off out of the gate with somebody that's going to be a bad apple to begin with? So it does work improving hiring processes. You want to indoctrinate them into your safety culture right off the get-go because most employers, they do an I-9, they give them a tour, and they hand them off to the employee that's about to mentor them. Best thing to do is to actually have a safety training on day one so they send a message. The younger workers. I had the fortune of speaking after a gentleman at the National School Bus Transportation Association. He was a psychologist. And what he had to say after years of study had a profound impact on how we now set up training for new employees and orientations for our clients. He said there's several aspects that have changed how some millennials, not all, have been brought up and affect how they work in the workplace. First off, someone said something about the switch. Well, the whole spare the rod mentality, right or wrong, or agree or don't agree, there's something to be said, like when a child was little and went to reach for up to get something off the stove, and it's a hot stove, if mom went and slapped that hand and said no, versus just saying no, that feeling, that pain receptor, created a pain receptor in the brain which actually ingrained that you shouldn't do that, it's going to hurt. Just saying no doesn't always create the same effect in the brain. So there's something to be said for immediate cause and effect. And because of that, he says the cause and effect in a lot of kids today that used to be through the young years, teenage years, was developed is not developing into their 20s now. Number two, the push to make children have better self-esteem. One of the things that they've done is win or lose, you show up, you get a ribbon or trophy for participating. So it's brought up issues that he says, based on his studies of those childs analyzing how they were brought up versus how they react, those that were in that kind of environment actually had issues showing up on time, doing extra things, or going that extra step, taking the initiative, as one said. So, like I said, it's not all of them, but it is something to keep in mind. Same thing goes with the whole timeout. You know, you send a kid to a timeout and they got a PlayStation and a television and it doesn't quite work. But right or wrong, that's what he found in his studies that impacts how millennials. So you have to, as we just saw, train them differently, explain more in detail than you may have had in the past why things are being done. And yes, when they come back, you have to listen to them and they may have a better idea. But you have to get them to understand first, you want them to learn to do the job the way you need to have it done, and then they come back and explain it. Because what typically happens in a mentoring program is they hand the employee off, they do the job for a week or so, and then they don't monitor them to the 90th day. If they start, let's say they have a gap in skill or knowledge relating to the job, they're very bright, they're very creative, they will try to find a way to do something. And it may end up causing them to get hurt because they don't understand all the nuances of the job, and it may cause them to cause a fire or something else. So they need to be monitored longer and listened to. So you guys were hitting the nail on the head from our studies. Training. They are going to come in and understand how well you train, lockout, tagout, welding, all this kind of stuff that you need to do, and they're going to score you based on your training. All this is going to compile into your final rates. Housekeeping. They don't expect your shops to be neat. They don't expect them to be dust-free. But they do want to see that there is nothing impeding fire safety or the safety of the employees from a slip and trip and fall. I don't know how many of you have had the safety or loss control person from the insurance company call you a half an hour, an hour out and say, I'm on my way. I hear that frequently. Why? Because they're trying to catch you with your guard down. They want to see, did you clean up because you knew we were coming for an inspection, or do you do this all the time? When it comes to dust, they want to know how often you're doing it. You're doing it continuously, or are you just doing it periodically? You're doing it every shift. And they also want to know how often you're doing deep cleaning. Because think about it, insurance companies, for you to have a fire, you have to have something to burn. You have the source of ignition. Obviously, you have lots of stuff to burn. They want to see how well you're managing it. And they're going to score you based on it. I'm not about to tell you how to do your business, but ultimately, I just want you to understand how the insurance companies score you. And like I said, they're not expecting you to be able to eat off the floor, but they just don't want to see big piles of dust accumulation over a prolonged period of time. Okay, with regards to maintenance, they want to understand, are you proactive or reactive? If you're waiting for something to break down before you do something with a piece of equipment, they're not going to like that and they're going to score you negatively. In fact, insurance companies have gone so far as to actually put endorsements and policies that will have an effect on how well they cover a claim or not cover a claim based on how well you maintain. So you're better off having a proactive process to maintain it. Electrical systems the same way. You want to make sure that they're clean and up to date. One of the best things you can do is do thermal imaging. A facility in Ohio and western Pennsylvania was built about 10 years ago. Within the first 6 months when we were doing our quarterly imaging, we found a line that was running hot. It had to do with a poor connection that was starting to loosen up. Got it fixed, moved on. 2-3 years later, had another line running hot. It had to do with a piece of machinery that the checklist that when they went through to maintain it didn't identify an issue because it was buried deep inside the machine, and it was causing it to draw more power or strain more, but it didn't trip the breaker yet. This enabled them to fix it before the machine got broken or caused a fire, maybe caused an injury. Interestingly enough, they have a $18 million piece of equipment in the main motor. About a year ago, we saw over high temperature on it. It's a sealed motor from Germany, so they actually had to order another one, and it came in 2 days before it broke down. So it can help you identify issues. You could either get a service, but they charge every time, obviously, or you could go get a camera. They're maybe under, you know, maybe about $1,000 now. You get a regular image and a thermal image next to it, but you got to get trained and understand how to use it. Okay. Welding. Talking to some of the insurance companies, some of the biggest fires that they have had in years have been caused by welding. Employees say, it's just something quick and easy. I'll just tack it a couple things, and they, next thing you know, there's sparks igniting something. You want to make sure the area is prepared, and they want to see, do you have a hot work permit? Do you make sure that the area is maintained? Do you do your flash watch? All that kind of stuff to prevent something from happening. If you notice, the best thing to do is for everything you do is have a record of it, because when you need documentation to go to the underwriter to make that case why you're a better risk, they love having that, because that's the paper trail that they want. Copies of your your hot work permits, copies of your maintenance records, how often you have safety committee meetings. Give them copies of those things. That paints you in a better picture. Painting is no different. Storage of material, electrostatic discharge, that's what they're looking for, making sure you're dealing with all that. Okay, fire safety. I was talking to you about the company that we had to put in a water retention pond. We had a similar issue with, I think they might have been a former member, I'm not sure, but they used to have a sawmill years ago until it burned, and then they're no longer in the sawmill. My friends Mark and Tim Baird at Baird Brothers out in Ohio. This is something that they do. They end up putting a water retention pond in. They have and more importantly, they have the the fire company come in every year. I was talking to one of the underwriters of Pennsylvania Lumbermen's, and they said they had a fire that the fire company showed up within 5 to 10 minutes, but spent the next half hour trying to get back to the building that was actually on fire. They didn't know how to get around it. There was impediments to getting through the facility. And then they were trying to figure out, was that the building that had the chemicals, or was it just storage? Because if they think there's chemicals, the fire company is not about the risk, their equipment, their men. So they will sit back and roast weenies and watch your building burn. Seriously. I've seen it happen. One of my clients was sat next to a chemical etching plant. The fire company sat back, watched it burn, and spread to the next two facilities because they did not want to get anywhere near it. So make sure that they can come in and do an annual survey, that inspection, that they maybe even do a test, that they have a map. If they need keys, make sure somebody there's got keys to get past your gates. It will help them respond to your fires faster. Make sure they know where the bag units, the silos are. Everything that would be of a hazard, they should know where it's at. And you need to do it annually because there's turnover. Not everybody's going to show up for the inspection every year. So it's a good thing to have. And then get a report from them that you can give to the insurance company. That will make them really excited. Sprinkler systems. The other reason why John up at Northern Hardwoods was not complaining is they went and put a sprinkler system in. So did the Baird Brothers. When you have a sprinkler system, you open yourself up to more insurance companies, and obviously a much lower rate. However, there is an investment cost. Before you just go and do that, you can negotiate with the insurance company and say, here's the system we're about to put in. What would it look like if we got pricing, for the insurance pricing? In the case of the Baird Brothers, it paid for itself in like 6.5 years. So it was a good investment over a period of time. But you want to make sure that it's maintained. And the last thing, I can't tell you how many times I've walked in and seen lumber stacked up almost to the sprinkler head. that's going to be an impediment to the fire. If you do things like that or you don't maintain your system and test it periodically, the insurance company say, thanks for the sprinkler system, but here's your rate as a no sprinkler system. So you have to watch and understand how is the insurance company scoring you when it comes to your sprinkler system if you have one. Okay. Lastly, can anybody tell me why insurance companies get so fixated on return to work? Anybody? Okay. Well, the main reason is workers' compensation, the payment of wages and medical, is unlimited. There is no dollar limit to a policy. I've seen workers' compensation injury claims in excess of $5 million for paralyzation. So they are concerned about maximum probable loss, just like your property carriers. So they're looking at it and saying, if you're an employer that participates and manages the return to work process, which ultimately reduces the cost of loss, which reduces your experience modifier, which reduces your premium, they're going to be much more aggressive on a rate. Let's think of this way. Back up. An insurance underwriter is going to look at your loss runs and say, okay, out of, hypothetically, $100,000 in injuries you've had over the last 5 years, $70,000 of it's wages and $30,000 it's medical. The industry average is 60% medical, 40% wages. So obviously, if you're having higher wage totals, you're not helping to manage the return to work process. Therefore, they're going to view it as they're more likely to pay out bigger claims. They're going to give you a bigger rate. So that's something for you to look at. So when you do have a claim, obviously we talked about safety. They want to know how well you train your employees to try to prevent injuries. But when you do have one, they want to understand how well do you do an accident investigation. Give them a copy of your form. You know, do you get witness statements? Do you get the supervisor statement to try to prevent fraudulent or exaggerated injuries? Did you determine whether it occurred really on the job or did it occur at home? We're seeing a spike in the number of claims, red flag claims, because ever since everybody started moving to higher and higher deductibles. Why? Workers' comp has no deductible. Health insurance may have $1,000, $2,000, $5,000. So employees are figuring that out and trying to get things covered under work comp. The biggest thing you can do is have a medical relationship with the clinic. Make sure they understand you, what you do, what are the requirements of the job, because ultimately, when an employee goes in, they're going to say, oh, I got to lift 100 pounds all day. I can't do this job. They may be just pushing a button, but that's what they told the doctor. The doctor is going to know and say, time out here. You know, throw that red challenge flag. No, you're going back to work. Here's the restrictions. So you want to make sure that they understand you're able to bring somebody back and under what conditions can you bring them back, you know, whether it be medium, light, sedentary duty. And sometimes some of the doctors will want job descriptions. It's a good thing to have because it also helps in the hiring process, but some of them will need it. But also, sometimes somebody might not be 100%, but they can still return to their job. All depends on what they do. Okay. I always like to ask this question. How many of you, by show of hands, have actually seen the submission from their agent before it went to the insurance company? Okay. This is normal. That's very rarely seen. I suggest you should take a look at it. See how well they did a write-up about you. What was the quality of the submission? Did they paint you in the best light to get you the best rates? You also want to know who they're going to. Not so much are you worried about assigning markets, but you want to know who they're going to so you can see what are the responses from the insurance companies. If they say they can't compete, okay, why can't they compete? Is there a reason? There usually is, because you didn't get in the scoring system, and they say, here's a risk. Interestingly enough, I can't tell you how many times I've heard an underwriter say, well, they have such and such of a risk or a piece of machinery that's unguarded. That machine was replaced 6 years ago. Remember, computers have lifetime memory. They're doing something based on a report 6 years ago. If they don't know it's changed, they're going to continue to assume it's there. So you want to understand why they're saying it and what are the responses so that ultimately you could decide, can you want to address it or not address it? Because that's a business decision. But ultimately, there are more companies that are wanting to actually write business than not write business. So you just have to make yourself more attractive and understand why or do they have an issue. If they said they declined, specifically, why did they decline? Because like I said, you might be able to address it. You also want to know what they're proposing in detail. If you remember, most of the gentlemen I spoke to all complained that when they changed companies, not even changed agents, changed companies, they realized later they were missing coverage that they once had. You need to understand what they're proposing and what are the core coverages that you need to cover your business. Manager experience modifier. Experience modifier is a big determination of your premium because it drives a perception of the underwriter, plus it's the math. Payroll, rate, experience modifier equals premium. Every dollar the insurance company spends on the claim increases your experience modifier for 3 years, which every point increase in your experience modifier increases your premium for 3 years. The mathematical impact of this is you will repay your claims with interest to the insurance company until you hit your claims cap, whatever that might be based on your size. If anybody's interested, I'd be glad to give you an experience modifier analysis and tell you exactly what your costs are. The best advice I can give is pretend you don't have insurance. If you do everything in your power to prevent something from happening, and when it does happen, to minimize it, and then you can convey what you're doing to the insurance company, you're going to get a lot better rates out of the insurance company. Because ultimately, face it, they don't want to pay any claims because then they make more money. So they're giving the best rates to the companies that they feel are not going to have claims paid out on them. Okay, I say, why do you buy insurance? Because you have to or because you want your claim paid? How many of you have driven down the road, seen a building that burned, boarded up, and then it never reopens? Or if it does reopen, maybe a year or two later goes out of business as a fire sale. Why? Statistics, every time I look at it, and it's probably be the subject of my next book, it has to deal with they are insured. It's just not they're insured properly. So you have to understand having replacement cost coverage does not mean you get a brand new building. Replacement cost means they will replace like kind and quality of what you had, not what you need to have based on current regulations and codes. Most policies, the very first exclusion in every policy out there, every policy, is ordinance or law. They will not pay to bring your building up to code unless you buy extra coverage. Some programs include some, maybe 50 or 100,000. Some might not include any. So imagine if you have a non-sprinkler facility that has to become sprinklered and the sprinkler system's going to cost you $7 to $10 a square foot. Better make sure you have enough coverage or you're going to be paying tens or hundreds or maybe $1 million out of your pocket to bring your building up to code to reopen. Every policy excludes foundations. Try to rebuild your building without a foundation. It has to be endorsed back onto the policy. I have no idea what that thought process was behind that. No logic to me whatsoever, but that's what they do. I guess they assume the foundation will still be there. Go figure. So you have to understand what is covered, what is not covered, and what are the coverages. And the other issue is improperly protecting cash flow. When I've talked to business owners that have closed up permanently, this is their main issue. They ran out of money. Either they weren't getting enough from the insurance company, or when it's all said and done, even though they reopened, their cash flow was poor after they reopened, and then they started funneling in their personal money and eventually said no mas. They can't go any further. There are ways to not only cover your income while you're down, cover the extra expenses to, let's say, outsource production to some of your friends and colleagues here. But ultimately, once you reopen, you could still get business income coverage after you reopen while you're ramping back up. And mind you, on these two issues, it's not uncommon for when I've analyzed losses, that the cost of bringing a building up to code might be 25 to 35% of what your original building was. And it's not, and business income might be as much as the building and contents coverage itself in some cases. So, and like I mentioned before, keep in mind workers' comp is not insurance. It's a finance toll. You will repay those claims. So with that, I thank you. For those that show up to the Q&A session, I'm going to draw five people to receive a copy of my book. Unless there's any questions at this time. And I'm 2 minutes early. I guess that, and I thank you. Before I forget, you can go to my website and sign up. I got a free newsletter you'll get every month.
That's the last of the formal presentations this afternoon. We will be having the open conversations, continuing the conversations. To my right, David Lang will be talking further about risk profiles. Over here on my left, Moringer, this is their first time exhibiting with us, and they have become a sponsor of the continuing the education. They will be doing some optimization at the Sawmill in the Yard presentation over there for anybody that wants to stay. And in the back of the room, Charlie Niebling and Greg True will be back there to answer all the questions that nobody got to ask them this morning. So if you want to go back there, take your pick, want to stroll around. We have some refreshments in the back. I think the beer and the wine cart is about ready to come in. So take a few minutes and spend some time with the gentleman that spoke with you this morning. Thanks so much.